Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, Associate Editor for Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our Editor-in-Chief, Lisa Henderson. For this episode, we are speaking with Jane Miles, Vice President, Clinical Trial Innovation at CureBase.
Throughout her career, Jane has worked on evolving the clinical research process and creating a more patient-centric approach. In her current role at CureBase, which started in August 2021, Jane is responsible for developing, maintaining, and promoting the company's DCT framework, assembling patient and physician advisory boards, and establishing academic and KOL leader partnerships. So thank you for joining us today, Jane.
Thank you very much for including me.
Yes, thank you again for joining us today, Jane. To get started, can you just describe your career journey?
Oh boy, how much time do you have? Okay, let's hit the high points. I studied in a university thinking I was going to go to med school. And then in fourth year, I had this class called pharmacology. And it was like my whole world opened up to a new discipline. So I ended up doing graduate work in pharmacology and starting to realize there was this whole industry on drug development I had no idea existed. After grad school, I actually ended up using those skills in, of all things, a petrochemical analytical chemistry lab. And that was great because I learned a lot of new techniques and that I didn't want to devote my life to petrochemical development. So then I ended up in a really interesting situation, working in an analytical chemistry lab in a pharmaceutical development company, really looking at the methodologies to ensure the clinical testing lots were safe and would be stable. And the more interesting part of that, aside from the chemistry, was this whole concept of self-directed work team management, which was a big experiment. So I was doing experiments within the frame of an experiment, which was really kind of cool. And why am I mentioning that? Because it kind of set me up to be on this path of questioning and trying to innovate the business process and the methodologies we use from day one of my career in pharma development. I flipped over into clinical operations in a Canadian affiliate organization for a big pharma company. And another gift happened for me because the first studies that I was attached to were in stage four pancreatic cancer patients who you probably know have a very terrible prognosis. And so I was actually taking care of the compassionate use program, which is not the same as registrational trials at all, but wow, did it ever inform my thinking? Because I was taking calls from family members and from doctors literally from the first week that I was working in clinical operations and understanding how much patients wanted access to these medications and how much necessary red tape existed around that process. So that's sort of like the early days. I ended up doing all kinds of interesting clin-ops work on all sorts of products. And I'm one of the fortunate few who actually had a lot of the products I worked on get through approval and actually become successful marketed drugs. So I worked in small molecules and big molecules. And then I ended up in a place where we were trying to transform medical textbooks by applying science in rare and unmet medical needs, doing biologic work. That was like the pinnacle of pharmacology and innovation in my mind. And about 10 years ago, I started to move away from the molecule level programs into portfolio wide programs, working first on patient recruitment and then evolving into patient facing innovation and leading a team of internal consultants who helped the portfolio understand, well, how could you do things differently and what impact might that have on either your timelines or your likelihood of achieving your objective? I don't mean your scientific objective. I mean more like your probability of technical success. Whew, that was a lot. I'll stop there because maybe you have a question.
That's awesome. Thanks so much, Jane. That's very interesting. So you said that you felt that your background with the analytical chem and your questioning the methodologies that went into the operations was kind of baked into your background. And then you moved on, like you said, into the compassionate use program. So that's like literally dealing with the patients and the families that seriously wanted access to whatever types of potential treatments there were. And then into the clinical operations and then patient recruitment and then up to the portfolio level. That's a lot of drug development experience. And so I'm just wondering, like, were there other specific experiences that led you toward this innovation? But is there anything that goes together in your mind?
A couple of things. So right after I did that work in the self-directed work team, I actually worked on process reengineering for 2 years, nothing to do with clinical operations. It was all about manufacturing, process engineering, and really looking at how things could be done in a different way and how you could push decision-making down. Again, nothing at all to do with clinical operations, but the big gift that happened for me there was the realization not everyone wants to change. I was very naive. And so learning some of those skills around listening and thinking about how to make the process a co-creation instead of pushing a process onto a group ended up being really important as I moved through my career, especially as I took on this concept of acting as an internal consultant to the organization. So there's listening and thinking through different options and working side by side with people to come up with what they thought was the best solution was really fundamental to my practice of innovation in late stage drug development. The other thing I think that was really cool and pretty unusual was that I had the opportunity to work on a submission for one of the most successful drugs ever. One that really, truly changed the course of disease for millions of patients. And the thing about that was the drug was really darn effective, but the way we got to the approval was radically different because we ended up partnering with oncology collaborative groups globally, not running the studies as a sponsor. And transforming those data sets into FDA ready registrational quality data was a really big magic trick. Not because the studies had not been done well, but because the methodologies that were used for data capture were pretty different from what a sponsor would typically do. Why am I telling you that? Because it showed me sometimes there is a really different way to approach a really hard problem that has a really massive impact on the patient population and the way medicine is practiced.
Can you tell us the drug?
Yeah, you might know it. It's called Rituxan. And of course, I got to work on a number of the follow-on versions of that sort of therapy. And really, I fell in love with the concept of making biologic molecules to meet very specific needs in fighting disease. And so it really went all the way back to that pharmacology and analytical chemistry and meeting patient needs all in one kind of amazing crucible.
Wow, that's all fascinating. To kind of follow on Lisa's original question, could you tell us maybe some specific experiences or thought patterns of what led you to working with CureBase?
So when I left my last big pharma company, I was working really deeply thinking about how do we evolve the clinical trial process? And we were thinking about it like 10 years out. What's this going to look like? How's that going to change? And I got the opportunity to work with a number of experts across the industry and, gosh, in consulting organizations. And remember, I had just spent about 7 years working on patient recruitment and patient-facing technology with trial teams across the entire portfolio. And I was like, wait, this technology is really fascinating, and yet it's kind of suboptimal. And I realized I was adding to the problem I was trying to solve. So I was trying to decrease burden to patients through optimizing design, offering them optionality, giving them ways to stay engaged with the trial without necessarily having to go to the research site. But I was doing it all with point solutions. And what I mean by that is there might be an engagement app, and there might be an e-consent tool, and there might be a mobile nursing organization to do some of the visits. But none of those solutions were integrated. And so my point solution alternatives were actually adding complexity for both patients and sites, which was exactly what I was trying to solve for. Oops. So it was a good lesson learned. Like, just because you can doesn't mean you should. And there has to be some really careful thought given to how to use these new solutions in a way that can indeed reduce burden to both the sites and the patients. So I had been thinking about this whole DCT concept using unified platforms and worked on that for a while at a major CRO, which was fascinating because I got to write all the business processes and develop all the internal training about how you might actually adopt these methods at scale. And then I found out about CureBase and thought, I could probably see how things changed a little faster in a little place like this. And I love the mission.
So CureBase is growing rapidly, as well as the decentralized approach, which everyone, you know, attributes to the pandemic and needing to pivot during that time. But as it grows, well, you may have already touched on this in your answer about joining the company because of you're not wanting to add to the burden. But what specific challenges are your clients faced with, and where are you seeing benefits with what CureBase offers?
I'm going to go back one step though, actually, Lisa, because when people say, oh yeah, this all happened because of the pandemic, I'm like, pshaw, no. That's when people woke up to the fact that this stuff was real.
Yeah.
But some of us who are really, really, I don't know what you want to say, stubborn. Stubborn is a good word. We've been at this since 2010 or earlier. That was made more clear to the entire drug development organization through the pandemic. I mean, that you could do things differently, and we pivoted, but we didn't do it in the optimal way. We did it out of need instead of by design. So that is actually one of the biggest hurdles now. People did pivot and they could see what was possible. They still probably saw it in a slightly suboptimal context because they were doing it to preserve trials instead of designing with the end in mind to use these solutions in the ideal way. Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. And I appreciate you pointing that out because it just makes a lot of sense.
So the hurdles, well, there's a bundle. It's not usually the tech, by the way. I'm giggling because one of the things I implemented in that CRO where I worked at was the concept of end user testing when we were developing new solutions. And end users in this case were people who would use the tool but were not familiar with it. And the aha there was that what my brilliant engineering team created worked, but humans couldn't always understand how to make it work. So the tech didn't fail. It was more about whether or not it was clear and simple for the end users to adopt. So that's a mission that is ongoing across the whole industry, but I think we're making progress. I hear a lot from sites that they are still faced a lot with that point solution issue that drove me to move to a place like CureBase. So in their words, sometimes sponsors are choosing the very best fit option from a domain. And what I mean by that is they will choose the provider they believe provides the very best e-consent experience. And that's not the same provider who they believe will give the best eCOA and ePRO experience. So they're still feeling very much the point solution environment. There's also a bunch of concerns about costs on both sides, actually. Sponsors are worried, is this actually increasing my cost? And sites are worried that they're going to lose money in terms of how trials are conducted and what proportion of the budget still aligns to what they do. So there's some things to work out there. But the one that I think is puzzling me most is, what is the regulatory shift that's coming, if any, around what constitutes a site and who has overall accountability for patient safety and protocol oversight in a trial? And I'm just becoming more aware of it as I speak more and more to sites. So now we know patients actually like the technology and the optionality. We know sponsors have proven to themselves, yes, this can work. They haven't necessarily proven to themselves it saves money. But sites are still at the early days of adoption in many of these solutions. And they're questioning, how does this help me?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because we've had some articles about, you know, the sites, obviously they don't want to be a tech support center, you know, if somebody has a question about how to use a solution that's implemented in the trial, you know, and who helps with that. So that's really good points about the safety and what is a site and what's that going to look like as we move forward. So just appreciate that.
I think also, to be honest, I do a lot of work with the Decentralized Trial Research Alliance, which you probably know, and we hear a lot of interest from people, both about the strategic and policy level things that they would like to have in place. What do I mean by that? Like, okay, telemedicine is possible, but there are some state-to-state laws that make it hard to execute. What's going on with that, and how might we shift it so it's easier to adopt? And then on the other extreme, I get input from people that their organizations are struggling because there isn't a stepwise process in their current set of tools to, say, set up e-consent. And they literally want checklist level support. I think both are important. And I think that that is work that's going to continue for some time.
Great. So before Lisa and I jumped on the podcast today, she was telling me that you guys had a conversation about educating digital health companies looking to run trials for their products and the need to get them up to speed on the rigor around clinical trials. So can you comment on the knowledge or cultural intersection of digital companies versus pharma companies?
Yeah, but I would say it's not just digital companies by any means. So We see a lot of new sectors interested in taking part in clinical research. Gosh, I think the most interesting one I saw recently was Best Buy. And while the tech solutions may be brilliant, I think sometimes if you haven't lived through what it takes to execute a clinical trial, maintain all the required documentation to support not just the data, but all of the things that happen within the clinical trial at the site, at the patient, and at the sponsor level, you might assume that you can automate everything. And you can automate a lot as long as you can document everything was done according to the protocol within the framework of GCP and ICH. Those parts are a little bit less obvious to some of the newer players in the space. Doesn't mean they won't achieve that knowledge. It just means that a lot of times I'm in conversation saying, so exactly where would you be documenting that? And where would I be able to see that? And how would a remote monitor get access to that documentation? And by the way, have you ever been through an audit? So it's not that I'm a disbeliever. It's more that I'm trying to make sure that they understand the expectations, because one of my revered former leaders and mentors made me think about it this way. When you waste the data contributed by a patient, you are committing the ultimate failure in a clinical trial. And that really informs why I'm being such a pain in the neck on all of those rigorous requirements.
I'm sure you're not a pain in the neck, Jane. I'm sure they appreciate you know, what you bring to the table and the, you know, walking through all those questions that they haven't considered. So I'm sure it's a shock more than.
Here's an example, and it's a very tiny one. It's not about tech, actually. So you might know I'm in some clinical trials myself as a healthy volunteer. And not too long ago, I got to go to the research site where I was in a trial and doing a sub-study where they collected just a bucket load of blood, literally. And the phlebotomist who did the draw had recently joined this clinical research site from a commercial lab within the hospital, literally half a mile down the road.
Okay.
And I was like, so what is it like? How is it different? And she said, oh my gosh, it couldn't be more different. And I was like, what? Like, really tell me what you mean by that. And she said, well, sure, I'm still doing blood draws and working with patients. But in my hospital role, my metrics were all about speed and throughput. And in this role, they're all about quality and documentation. I was like, oh, I love you. Because now that I've just given you my literal bucket of blood, I want to make sure those samples get to where they need to and are identified to me.
That's the best succinct story. That makes so much sense. You must, like you said, you really appreciated it.
I did. And, you know, she was also very good at doing the stick. So
yeah. Oh, yeah. That's greatly appreciated.
Yeah.
And we also appreciate you joining us today, Jane. I really, your insights and comments and goals, actually, you know, your whole background and everything leads to where you are in almost a perfect way. So
it kind of does.
Yeah.
For people who are earlier on in this career journey, I feel like I'm the old crone or something, but that's not my intention at all. I like to encourage people, like, don't imagine you need to have everything planned out.
Right.
Take every opportunity that inspires you because you're going to learn something, even if you learn that you hate it. But I decided when I entered the industry that I was going to operate on the principle of yes, not the principle of no, in terms of trying things that I hadn't imagined I would do. That doesn't mean I will say yes to every possibility that is presented to me in my innovation role, but that opportunity to learn and grow and come at things from a different perspective has really been invaluable. And to your point, Lisa, I didn't expect that it would help me do what I do now, but I couldn't do what I do now without having been through that.
Excellent. Thanks again, Jane. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're so very welcome. I hope that this is sort of not too babbly and you can make sense of it.
It's perfect.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you, Jane.